a very interesting woman to begin with. Her name is Tracy Fessenden. Tracy Fessenden is the Steve and Margaret Foster Professor in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies in Arizona State University. She's also the author of a couple of other books called Culture and Redemption, Religion, the Secular, and American Literature. She wrote a book about Billie Holiday, which I thought was amazing, mixing elements of biography with the history and race of American music. Tracy Fessenden explores the multiple religious influences in Holiday's life and sound, including her time spent as a child in a Baltimore convent, the echoes of Black Southern churches in the blues she encountered in brothels, the secular riffs of ancestral faith in the poetry of the Harlem Renaissance, and the Jewish songwriting culture of the Pan Alley. Fessenden looks at the vernacular devotion scholars call lived religion, the Catholicism of the streets, the Jewishness of the stage, the Pentecostalism of the roadhouse, or the concert arena, alongside more formal religious articulations in institutions, doctrine, and ritual performances. Insightfully compelling, Fessenden's study begins unexpected materials of archival voices to bear on the shaping of Billie Holiday's exquisite craft and an indelible persona. Religion Around Billie Holiday is the name of the book, and it illuminates the power and durability of religion in the making of an American musical show. I think you're going to find her quite interesting. And everybody, that on the phone with me is Tracy Fessenden. She's the author of the book called Religion Around Billie Holiday. Seeing we're really up to the date here with time, those of us who know something about Billie Holiday's difficult childhood know that she spent much in brothels, but she also spent time in a convent reformatory called the House of Good Shepherd. Can you tell us why?
Yes, she was assigned to the care of the Sisters of the Good Shepherd on two occasions in Baltimore. She was caught up in an effort to give some kind of formation to girls whose parents could not or would not be present in their lives. And so when she was just short 10 years old, Billie Holiday, whose name at that time was Eleonora Gough, was sent to the House of the Good Shepherd for colored girls, is what it was called. There were two Houses of the Good Shepherd in Baltimore, one for white girls, one for colored girls. Billie Holiday was sent to the latter. And at that time, she was there with a group of girls who were essentially orphaned by their caregivers or were street kids deemed in need of direction. When she was released from the House of the Good Shepherd about a year later, she lived pretty much on her own because her mother was in and out of her life. Other relatives threw up their hands at various points because Eleonora Gough at that point was already very much a fixture on the sort of underground music scene, if you can imagine, at age 11 or 12 in Baltimore. And during Prohibition, of course, musicians gravitated toward good time houses, speakeasies. She was caught up in a trafficking proceeding, which was also a rape proceeding. She was found with an older man who was a musician when she was 11 now, and sent back to the House of the Good Shepherd, this time with a group of girls who were seen to be at risk sexually. Either they were themselves being trafficked, or they were seen by caregivers or the state to be at risk of becoming prostitutes. So she was back at the Good Shepherd for that reason at the age of 11.
Goodness. Was she a practicing Catholic? And what does her headstone say?
Well, her headstone says, "Hail Mary, full of grace." And she was buried with her mother, who was very much a practicing Catholic, Sadie Fagan, only after some some difficulty with her her then husband not wanting her to be buried with her mother with a marked headstone. When she died, a wealthy Catholic layman wanted to finance her funeral and burial, but Louis McKay, then Billie Holiday's husband, intervened and said no. I'm not entirely ready to make judgments about whether Billie Holiday was a practicing Catholic. I do know she received the sacraments. She had a good priest friend in her life, someone from Boston, Norman O'Connor, Father O'Connor, who was the chaplain at Boston University and who also was a jazz DJ. And she was a friend of Mary Lou Williams, the Catholic jazz composer, who remembers the two of them praying the rosary together. So she did have a Catholic formation. She learned at the Good Shepherd about the lives of the saints. She received baptism, made a confession. So these were formative elements of her life, I believe, whether or not she considered herself a practicing Catholic.
It's amazing because we had a House of Good Shepherd here in Boston.
Yes, I do. I remember. I'm from Boston. And my mother actually told me that her mother would threaten to put her into the House of the Good Shepherd when she misbehaved. So they were all over. There were Houses of the Good Shepherd in 40 states at the beginning of the 20th century.
From what I've found out around in this particular area was it was mostly for girls that were either promiscuous are in a situation that might be sexually dangerous to them.
Yes, yes. And, you know, Charlotte, when you put it that way, one of the really striking things about this era and the judgment of promiscuity was that a girl who was herself being trafficked as a prostitute and a girl who just began exercising some sexual agency at an early age would have been put in just the same category. They were both at risk.
Right.
And
even stepfathers and uncles and things like that.
Yes. You know, I wonder, when I look at materials from that period, there were a group of girls at the House of the Good Shepherd for colored girls who had been in and out of the convent a few times, sent back a few times. And the House of the Good Shepherd for colored girls in Baltimore was the only House of the Good Shepherd in America that had what they called a group of Magdalens. And they actually called them the Colored Magdalens.
Yep.
And these were a group of girls, 14 at the time that Billie Holiday was there, who had taken perpetual vows as sisters. And you see a picture of them. These are beautiful teenage girls in full habits of the Sisters of the Good Shepherd, although they were not recognized as being full-fledged sisters within the order at that time. And I look at their faces, and I wonder what would have possessed them to stay in the convent permanently, to stay in the convent for life. And I think that you put your finger on it. It was because at least one reason was because many of these girls knew what was waiting for them outside, and they may have been in very, very difficult situations with family members or men outside their families.
For their own safety.
For their safety, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
For their safety and also for the convenience of their caregivers, for the convenience of the state. The second time Billie Holiday went back to the House of the Good Shepherd, what she told the police who arrested the man that she was with and then a couple who seemed to be in the sex trafficking business, she said, well, I ran away to this couple that I know from this part of my life because my mother threatened to put me in a home. So Billie Holiday's mother had also spent time in the House of the Good Shepherd 20 years earlier, and she was on her way back to New York, it appeared, and thought it would be better for her daughter to be in the House of the Good Shepherd. Billie Holiday ran away to avoid that fate and ended up right back in the convent in the House of the Good Shepherd.
That is amazing. It really is. When I think back into those times, of course, I lived through it.
Yes, yes.
And I think of the things that happened all under the umbrella, so to speak, of religion.
Yes, yes.
I'm going to skip the part about her background in that, but what do scholars mean when they talk about lived religion? And what are some of the examples of how it shows up in American popular music? And why does the spiritual energy surrounding mid-20th century jazz feel particularly dense?
Those are all such big questions. Lived religion, I can tell you and your listeners, is a large part of what scholars of religion study today. That is, we don't confine ourselves to what happens in church or what pronouncements are made by religious leaders. We have become, in the last decade or so, much more interested in how religion is lived on the ground, how people actually experience their relationship to religion, whether they are religious or not. So, for example, even if Billie Holiday was not going to church in her adult life, my perception of her persona is that it was very much shaped by the experience of confession. So that's a form of lived religion. If you listen to American popular music, particularly the work of black musicians in the 1920s and 30s, you can hear very much this in the work of many of the major vocalists, particularly the women vocalists, women like Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, the wonderful blues singers. You really hear a church sound in their voice, even though these were women who, for the period that they were blues singers, at least, had left the church behind. Good riddance, we're doing something very different. The style of powerful moaning, the sort of depth of feeling in these women's voices very much has a kind of church pedigree. If we think about the songwriting culture of Tin Pan Alley and all of the great 20th century songs that we know from Broadway musicals or Hollywood, most of these were written by Jewish songwriters who had come to America in flight from Eastern European terrorism and were experiencing a different kind of freedom, a different way of relating to other cultures, to religious pluralism. So even though you don't hear much that sounds specifically like religion in that music, once you know the context, once you know something about the background of these songwriters and others who made the music, you can start to hear what I think of as lived religion in that sound. It, rock and roll very much has a sort of origin story in gospel music and in the cadences of preachers who began to record their sermons in the 1920s and 1930s. So music, I think, is a wonderful place to study religion, because religion has a kind of ambient quality. It's in the air, whether you are practicing or not. Music has that ambient quality.
I was just thinking of the Baptist religion and how you can go by a Baptist church and you want to start singing.
Of course, yes, yes.
I can understand it being why music and religion go together.
Yes, and you know, some of Billie Holiday's accompanists who would play in cabarets till the wee hours of the morning said, yeah, you know, we'd get out on Sunday morning. We'd make sure we were out by 7 or 8 a.m. so that we could go to church and hear more jazz, because that's what they heard in church was the same kind of music that they were making in nightclubs, many of them.
Mm-hmm. How does Holiday's experience of confession inform her persona and her repertory?
Well, that is a place where I've had to really do a lot of listening and a lot of interpreting and some speculation, of course, because Billie Holiday was not a self-chronicler. She didn't keep a diary. She didn't say a very good deal about what was going on inside. She gave very few interviews, and always during the interviews she wants to talk about music, understandably. But I know from the kind of teaching that the Sisters of the Good Shepherd were undertaking with these young girls, including Billie Holiday, that confession, teaching a pupil to make a good confession, was a very important part of their work, and that required mining one's experience for occasions of pain, of guilt, of shame, of discomfort, and of turning those to good in some sense. In the sacrament of confession, one turns those experiences to good by airing them, by speaking them aloud. And then in the confessional, the priest who hears one's confession will assign a penance, a duty or a ritual, something that the child or the confessor can perform in order to regain a kind of equilibrium. And I think that when we hear Billie Holiday voice in her music, some of the anguish that she is feeling, some of the pain she is feeling, what I hear is that's part of a process. It's part of a larger structure of creating from the materials of despair, the materials of pain, something lasting, something freeing, something that is of eternal significance. And that is very much what she would have learned about confession at the House of the Good Shepherd.
It when you think about it, it's like going to a psychiatrist in a sense, because he makes you look inside yourself and find your own answers.
And when yes. And Billie Holiday would not have had a psychiatrist, particularly as a young girl. She would have had. She would have had the confessional.
Right. I mean, I'm trying to compare it with today's the way things are today. I'm dyslexic, also. Oh goodness. If we listen for religion in the music of Billie Holiday's era, what would we hear? And where do we hear the traces of the Mass in Holiday's music?
Well, Charlotte, as you pointed out, if we were in Harlem in the latter 20s or the early 30s when Billie Holiday was making her start, we would walk down the street and probably hear some rousing music from storefront churches. We might hear something somewhat similar in cabarets. The wonderful gospel singer Sister Rosetta Tharpe, just inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, was a holiness singer. She sang holy roller hymns, and she also sang at the Cotton Club in Harlem and really wowed audiences with what Billboard magazine first described as rock and roll. That's the first instance we have of rock and roll in American print. It's a description of this wonderful gospel singer. So we would hear that kind of sound. What Billie Holiday might have heard was a kind of sound that was different from the church sounds she would have heard growing up. The Catholic Church musical culture is very different from that of a Black Baptist or Holiness church. Mm-hmm. And what Billie Holiday learned to sing, she did have formal vocal instruction at the House of the Good Shepherd. As far as I can tell, that's the only formal vocal instruction she had. But she would have learned there to sing according to the forms that were set forth in the Book of Gregorian Chants that all Catholics were trained from in the Mass. All choirs at the time were trained to sing from. And this was a form of chant that had been the subject of a great deal of sort of musical and spiritual energy fairly recently, in the decades before Billie Holiday learned to sing at the House of the Good Shepherd. The effort of a group of monks at a monastery in France called the Salem Monastery was to, as they saw it, restore Gregorian chant to the purity of what they imagined were the earliest forms of chant. That is, they wanted to free chant from a sound that was probably more Baroque sounding. When chant was first scored in the 17th and 18th century, it was made to sound familiar to 17th and 18th century European ears. But the monks at Salem wanted to free chant to make it more like ordinary speech, to make the notes to instruct those who sang to voice the notes very quickly and lightly, to free the vocal rendition from the strictures of strictly metered time. And that's what Billie Holiday would have learned when she was accepted.
So
when we hear her jazz, I hear very much that kind of effort in regard to the music.
Yeah, the liturgy. I remember that. I went to parochial school, so even though I wasn't Catholic.
Yes, well, many students did. It was seen in many neighborhoods to be the place for kids to get a better education. Yeah.
Well, my father was dead set on me getting an education, and he also feared for me, you know, being out alone.
Yes.
So he put me in a parochial school. It was my protection, believe it or not. But that's another story. What was Holliday's role in the making of a jazz martyr? And what do you mean when you state Holliday's addiction and objection were not incidental to her identity as an artist?
Well, I think, Charlotte, when we think about Billie Holiday, this is what I've found in talking with people about this book. Many people have a perception of Billie Holiday as a very tragic figure. If they know very little else about Billie Holiday, they may know that she died at a young age, at 44, that she was a heroin addict, that her songs were very directly about very painful kinds of experience, a lynching, of course, in Strange Fruit, suicide in Gloomy Sunday. And so the perception of Billie Holiday, I believe, that is widely shared, is that she was a kind of a very sad figure, a tragic figure, a kind of martyr. And of course, many of her jazz contemporaries did also live very, very difficult lives. Charlie Parker died at 34, worn away by heroin. Lester Young died just a few months before Holiday, very much compromised by alcohol. And these stories are very common in jazz culture. Billie Holiday, I think, certainly was not. She was caught up in some of the very difficult, damaging circumstances that might have surrounded an African American woman singer at that time. I think she also had, because of her particular background, and I believe her relation to Catholicism, had a kind of aesthetic relationship to suffering. And this is something that has been a real challenge for me to make sense of in a way that does not reduce her to a suffering figure, which plenty of people are able to do with Billie Holiday, nor am I interested in imagining that she somehow redeemed her experience completely, or that she flew free of it, or that she was triumphantly resilient and none of it affected her. I think she played the hand she was dealt. She encountered her circumstances in a very truthful way. And the result is a sound that that to me sounds like someone who has had a very great deal of experience with pain and suffering. She didn't attempt to hide her addictions necessarily. She was not interested at all in pretending that she was someone she was not. And the result is that we have, I think, a very truthful picture of, in some cases, the agony that Billie Holiday lived as an African-American woman, as a woman who had been through this very, very painful set of experiences in childhood. At the same time, she sang some of the most liltingly joyful songs we have, and that was also very, I think, very true to her experience.
Mm-hmm. In the book, there was another question that goes, but I think you've already answered it. Was it prejudice, marketing, politics, or some of each?
Yes. Well, she, the very first record that she made with producer John Hammond, who was a remarkable figure in American music, took credit for discovering most of what we think of as, the luminaries of American music, from Bessie Smith to Bruce Springsteen, paid her $7.50 for each of the two songs that she recorded in her first recording session. And that was it. No royalties. No residuals. That was the money that she made, $15. And that was very, very common for black singers in whatever genre, blues, jazz, whatever they recorded into the microphone. They were paid on the spot and didn't see money again. So that was an experience that she shared with many of her contemporaries. And I think that experience of prejudice also went to the shaping of her persona and the way she was regarded.
There's two closely related myths have surrounded Holliday. One of that she was a natural, and the other is that she suffered for it. Why are these myths so pernicious, and did she cultivate those myths?
The view that African American singing, in particularly, was a gift that came naturally to performers was very, very common among white audiences, white record buyers. It's a fascinating kind of projection or mechanism, I think, for making sense of for white listeners, white producers, for making sense of the structure of exploitation and abuse that many of these artists lived with. The understanding, I think, on the part of someone like John Hammond was that these people would be making music anyway, so I don't need to pay them, that there's something very natural about an African-American man or woman singing, and this is simply what they do, and we will appreciate them, but there's no need to honor them with legal kinds of contracts and a legitimate pay structure, etc. When the folklorist John Lomax and his son Alan Lomax found the great blues singer Leadbelly in a Angola, Louisiana prison in the 1930s, they brought him to the North and recorded him. Leadbelly became a big blues star, but the press that covered Leadbelly's performances in the North did again and again recur to this image of the black singer as natural, as someone who just naturally sings his beautiful notes, naturally plays these chords, and that imputation of naturalness also clung to Holiday. I think it sticks particularly when those who know something about her life see no evidence of formal instruction formal practice. Charlie Parker famously practiced for 14 hours a day, and we don't see Billie Holiday in that kind of very disciplined rehearsal mode. We seldom see her in that mode. So I think that there's a tendency on the part of many observers to say, well, this was just a natural gift that she had, which certainly undercuts the immense discipline and craft that she brought to her work as a singer, the incredible exquisite care that she gave to every note that she sang.
Now, the thing, we're getting close to time, and I want to make sure there's so much I want to know. Anyway, she had a record label, Columbia, I believe it was, and they refused to let her sing "Strange Fruit."
Yes.
Why?
John Hammond was the producer at Columbia Records, and he thought that "Strange Fruit" was just too controversial. As your listeners are certainly aware, "Strange Fruit" is a searing witness to a lynching, and Billie Holiday was the first to record this song. She records it in the most unflinching way. There's nothing in the song that is redemptive. There's nothing that points to a brighter future. It is very much an excruciating account of what it is to be in the presence of that crime, which was pervasive, even at the time that she was singing. We have 44,000 documented cases of lynching in the 20th century. No doubt there were many, many more that went undocumented. So Hammond just didn't want to touch this. He thought that it was not seemly for Billie Holiday to sing about lynching. She was such a good singer. She had such a wonderful sound. She could swing. Why not entertain? And she was not interested in entertaining. And so this song was very, very moving, of course, for so many people. Hammond decided that Columbia Records just shouldn't go there. But another label did record the song, and it, of course, became one of Billie Holiday's best known.
I know. And the thing, there was quite a deal about the who wrote the poem. There was,
Yes. Do we have time to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, go. I'm good.
Okay. The composer and the lyricist of "Strange Fruit" was a Jewish labor leader, a real rabble rouser, a wonderful sort of poet activist named Abel Meeropol, and he was an extraordinary figure. As a young man, he took the name Lewis Allen because he and his wife had two children who died in infancy. Their names were Lewis and Allen, and that was the name that he took as a composer. When the Rosenbergs were executed, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, Abel Meeropol adopted the two Rosenberg children, who then were very young boys, and they. So he had an amazing story, an amazing life. He wrote. He was very much a civil rights activist, and he wrote the song "Strange Fruit" as a protest against lynching. When the book "Lady Sings the Blues," which was Billie Holiday's autobiography, came out, there was a passage about this song that suggested that Billie Holiday had had a hand in the writing of it. And of course, if you know Billie Holiday's music, you know any song that came her way, she did make her own. She gave her own distinctive flourish to it. Doesn't sound anything like anyone else's recording of that song. So in a sense, she was right. It was, she did put her stamp on this song. She did change it when she recorded it. But Mirepoix was adamant that he be credited with the words and music, and his two sons, have continued that effort, have wanted to say, no, this was not Billie Holiday's song. It was Abel Mirepoix's song. And part of the reason, I think, is that they want to preserve and make visible the history of African-American and Jewish cooperation in civil rights. Right. It's a history that gets lost often and certainly is worth revisiting. But I think at bottom, Billie Holiday and Abel Mirepoix had different ideas for the song. Given Abel Mirepoix's investments in progress, in making progress, in bringing about a better world, in lining up on the right side of history, "Strange Fruit," in the way that Abel Mirepoix originally scored it, had that forward-looking feel. It was almost a march when he originally scored it. We are marching toward progress. We are marching toward a better future. When Billie Holiday sings it, it's very much a witness to evil and injustice in the present. It's not about a brighter day ahead. And I think that difference is really at the heart of their disagreement over the song's authorship.
I'm still glad that he did that, because I'd like to see the connection. I want other people to see it also.
Yes, but yes.
Writing in the Progressive News, labor historian Brandon Weber recently laid out a case that Holiday's recording of "Strange Fruit" was ultimately what killed her. And he's got a website, Strange Fruit. Anyway, what's his evidence, and do you agree?
That is a very compelling argument. It sort of makes sense of the materials, that it was by singing "Strange Fruit," this very controversial song, that put the scene of lynching in people's living rooms where they might be listening to records, that attracted the attention of the FBI and federal agents, and also local drug enforcement officers were relentless in hounding Billie Holiday. And some say that it was that was what killed her, that she was followed to her deathbed by federal agents who arrested her in the hospital for the possession of heroin, and that she never had a chance to develop a healthier set of behaviors. That she was her experience with heroin was not only physically ravaging, but the fact that she was constantly under surveillance, constantly in danger of being arrested and thrown into jail, also made it that much worse. Did "Strange Fruit" prompt that kind of scrutiny of Billie Holiday? Is it what put law enforcement on her trail? I would have to say, as compelling as that theory is, that is really not the case. The song certainly created controversy, but the reason that she became the target for federal law enforcement, as far as I can reconstruct, is simply because she was so magnetic, so beautiful, so talented, and the drug czar at that time, the first drug czar, his name is Harry Anslinger, wanted himself to be famous. He wanted to be in the papers. He loved arresting famous people. He wanted to take advantage of this culture that romanticized drugs and romanticized criminals by being on the law's side of that that drama. And so he was very, very attracted to Billie Holiday as his prey, as his target. And it's ironic and sad that so many other jazz musicians used drugs and were not caught up in the machinations of the law. Lots of them had police protection, had agents who bought off the federal law enforcement officers. But Billie Holiday, in part, it looks also that her own manager, Joe Glazer, liked to see Billie Holiday in the papers. associated with drugs, with criminality, because that made her that much more valuable to him. It made her that much more compelling a figure. However, it wasn't Strange Fruit that created that dynamic. I think in many ways Strange Fruit was Billie Holiday's protest against that dynamic. And I don't think that it was something that law enforcement considered in its pursuit of her.
She was
it
used.
Stands as a testimony to what she lived through, but it wasn't what prompted their pursuit of her.
She was definitely used as a commodity instead of a person.
Very much so, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, from age 12, you're right. That's a beautiful way of putting it.
She partnered with a series of abusive men. She was also revered in some circles as a feminist icon. How do you see it?
That is a very, very painful part of her story, that the men she was attracted to were physically abusive men. Many of them beat her physically, lived on her earnings. Her last husband, as one biographer, as her terminal husband, had pretty much abandoned her by the end, but made sure that he took every penny from her estate, and these passed to his sons from a prior marriage. So she was very often in the company of men who were willing to abuse her financially, physically, sexually. I don't want simply to condemn. It's obviously we condemn these behaviors. I don't want to leave it at that. I want to think about how Billie Holiday managed still to encounter some form of power in those relationships that she could use in her art, turn to her advantage in some way. And I think that those of us who see Billie Holiday as an incredibly strong, forceful, powerful presence do so knowing that she had these very violent relationships, that she was often in the company of men who abused her, and yet managed to create a very distinctive, very individual, irreplaceable, unique musical identity that will always be with us, continues to shape music today.
Mm-hmm. In a 1956 interview, journalist Mike Wallace asked Holiday why so many jazz greats die early. What was her response?
It's very interesting. She doesn't say because of drugs, because of prejudice, because we're treated poorly, all of which was true. She says it's because we want to live so much. We want so much to live each day, to meet everyone, to, as Holiday said, to eat all the best foods, to be where life is, and as she said, to sing every note, to follow every phrase, to live intensely. And she said that's why we die early. It's we live 100 years in 1 year, as she put it. And that was certainly true with her. She never shrank back from intensities of various kinds. She threw herself into what life threw her way, and her musical oeuvre is the result.
I've truly enjoyed this interview, and I know I've kept you over time.
Oh, Charlotte, thank you so much. I have so enjoyed talking with you.
Can you tell people where they can acquire your books?
Oh, yes, of course. Amazon, it's there. It will be shipping in about a week, and it's available for order. It's also available through Penn State University Press. And if your listeners are interested, they can get a discount from Penn State University Press if they write TF18, Tracy Fessenden, 2018, TF18 on the order form. They'll get a discount, which brings the price down about $10.
Perfect. Perfect.
Yes.
Thank
you,
you,
Charlotte,
so much.
I've so enjoyed it.
I'll be right
Thank you.
I'll be right back.